Merba l-semmija ta' Campus FM għal-program ta' ħdita klio. Ma' Emanuel Buttigieġ u li jimgawċi, pero l-lum ma' Emanuel Buttigieġ bis għax li jimgawċi ma' setax ikun ma'na. Pero benix wahdi il-għalix l-lum għanna mistinna speċjali għanna ma'na l-Dr. Ilaria Scalia minn Aston University of Birmingham. Dr. Ilaria Scalia hija speċjalizzata fin-nisġa bejn l-istorja internazzjonali, speċjalment dik ta' bejn iż-żewġ gwerer dinjija, u l-istorja tal-emozzjonijiet. U għandha interess ukoll kif l-arkivju t-teknoloġija jilagħbu parti f'din in-niġġa. U fil-fatt magħha llum ankollu din nesploraw din in-niċċa tant interessanti ta' l-istorja tal-emozzjonijiet. Ilaria, welcome. I was just explaining to our audience that you are an expert in the history of international relations, especially in relation to the interwar period, that you also look at this wonderful niche, which is the history of emotions, as well as the history of archives and the related technology. So these are some of the things we'll be exploring together. I hope you're feeling well today.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I guess we'll start with the big question. What is the history of emotions? Because I'm sure for many of us, this is a new thing.
Yes, it's a field of history that studies how emotions differed and changed over time. And we might think of emotions as universal, still, beyond comprehension. But then upon reflection, we might realize that they do differ and they do change across time and space. Think about love, just to pick something happy. How people understand it, how people express it, how they regulate it. Certainly has changed across time, is still very different in different countries, in among different cultures, among different groups. And so historians of emotion study how this change. But also they study the function that emotions played in different settings at different times. Think about anger in political discourse. Think about different attempts at triggering compassion or empathy or sympathy for other people. Now, they might differ in their approach. Some historians might emphasize words, mind. Others might look at images or sound. Some emphasize the body, the sensorial, the neurological aspect. But they all agree that what people felt or said they felt or tried to make others feel matters and deserves to be incorporated in our historical narrative, in the history that we study, and in the history we teach.
How new is it as a field of study?
Well, in reality, we can look back and find different elements connected and useful for this field throughout the history of historical writing. But I would say it's really in the last two or three decades that it really boomed.
Right.
And now it's certainly quite established. Some even speak of an emotional turn in historical writing in many different fields.
Yes. So we had the linguistic turn, had the visual turn, and now
the emotional turn.
Fantastic. Is it mostly to be found in sort of English-speaking universities? Is it mostly an Anglo-Saxon phenomenon as a field of studies? Or do you find its equivalents? You're Italian, but you work in the UK. I mean, is it found, for instance, in Italian universities?
Well, there are places in Italian universities where there are scholars who follow this. The main centers, the main research centers that have been spearheading this, a major one is the Center for the History of Emotions at the Max Planck Institute in Berlin. And that's certainly one of the driving ones. There is a major one in the UK. There's another big one in Australia.
Yes.
So UK, Queen Mary in Australia. Also there is a major institute in Tampere in Finland where they specialize on the history of experience, which is a very but closely related field. So, but certainly there is quite a bit of historiography in English. There are many works in French also.
Okay.
And in terms of period, medievalist, Renaissance scholars have truly driven the field for a long time.
Oh, I see.
And now more and more we see its expansion in all different studies and time periods and areas.
Now, you have a fabulous book on international relations between the two world wars with this wonderfully, I found, original angle of the Alps. and the history of emotions that mm-hmm. is tied to the Alps and internationalism in the 1920s and 1930s. So the book follows a number of people and institutions that somehow are all linked to the Alps. and you try to explore how they understood their emotions and how those feed into the politics and how the politics feed into them. That's a very nutshell kind of description. Mm-hmm. And I suppose I have three questions. I'll say them and then we can repeat them. So why the Alps? Why this moment? And who were these people?
Yeah, so I will start from the end.
Sure.
Who were these people, right? So there were states, there were individuals, sometimes politicians, but sometimes regular people from all sides of the political spectrums. We're involved in international initiatives in the 1920s and the 1930s, but also many non-governmental institutions. I looked at a broad spectrum from mountaineering clubs to international schools to international health organizations that later on would evolve into what we know, for instance, as the World Health Organization, but all sorts of independent groups. Why now, right? That after the First World War, in the aftermath of what at the time had been an unprecedented conflict in terms of scale, certainly considered emotion something they needed to worry about, they needed to think about. Partially because many people suffered of shell shock, what today we know as PTSD, right? Post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yes, yes.
Partially because individual groups like the ones I described blame the war in many ways of passions gone out of control. Hatred, people losing control of their life and what they were doing.
Yes.
And they also thought that triggering friendship was going to be the solution to avoid another conflict of this kind. They thought that peace would really originate from an authentic, genuine friendship, they would call it, or amicability. You know, they had all sorts of terms to describe this, but a bond among people. And they thought that the Alps and mountains in general could facilitate that. And there was a history already of mountains in the Alps in particular as a destination, as a tourist destination, but also as a political one.
Mm-hmm.
Nationalist regimes, this is usually our first association, right, tended to pick them as a place to go to. But also communist groups, Catholic groups, all sorts of different people, again, and institutions and groups picked them as a place that they thought, by shape, by its beauty, by the kind of challenges he posed, helping each other while climbing or trying to weather a storm together, would somehow help to create that kind of bond. And so by the time we get to the 1920s...
It's like a fellowship of the ring when they're going on the mountain.
And so there was also a parallel tradition, which is well studied, of mountains as a place for individuals, for people alone, but there was also a collective experience of the mountain that by the time we get to the 20s and the 30s really becomes a preferred way or approach for people trying to build peace after the First World War.
So there is a sort of pilgrimage element almost to it.
Well, there is a long history of pilgrimage on the mountains, right, due to sanctuary and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But it also becomes sometimes a destination for what today we would call a field trip, taking children, for instance, on an outing. There is this idea that up on the mountain, something genuine comes up. Think about Heidi. The story, right? Which really the novel comes out in the 1880s, but then we have films produced in the 20s and the 30s, all sorts of novels that sentimentalize the experience of the mountain as one that brings people together.
This is part of
what I explore in the book,
That it's a place which is more genuine, more closer to nature,
cleaner,
not corrupted by urbanism and all that. No, it's all there, isn't it?
And that's why then they pick it also for sanatoria, for the cure of tuberculosis, for instance, right?
Right.
There was a medical reason, but also an emotional, psychological one that they thought could facilitate healing that was, you know, psychological and emotional in people too, together with the physical one.
So how did you get to this subject?
I, first of all, come from the Alps, so I wanted to write a book that was about home.
Mm-hmm.
And coming from a background of international history and international relations, I was often struck by how the League of Nations, though based in Geneva, mm-hmm. which is not really a mountain city, often emphasized this alpine aspect, you know, the proximity to the mountains. You find it in all of its publicity. In fact, the Palais des Nations was built so that the delegates could see the Alps right after they came out, you know, to the friendship. Okay. So I was struck by that element of publicity that didn't necessarily match with the perception of Geneva as a city that one would have if you just visit Geneva. And again, coming from the Alps, I was often struck by how certain foods or rituals, like eating fondue, for instance, were really often portrayed as this moment of gregariousness, everybody there, you know, together doing this, you know. And there's an element of stereotype, I guess, connected to this. But doing research for the book, I realized these things were made. Somebody at one point trademarked the fondue. Somebody decided to advertise these products as in a particular way. So in many ways, this image was constructed, was really made. And then when I researched, you know, the emotions of internationalism, the book I wrote, and I was looking at these people sick with tuberculosis, you know, all together dipping in the same fondue pot, you know, so that they could be friends. I couldn't help but thinking that, yes, on one hand, it made me cringe from a sanitary standpoint, especially in COVID times, but also to reflect about the enormous effort that has been put in the last two centuries to make people be friends, to make people encounter. Mm. And I realized how I was the product of that. The international studies program that I was a student in, my own participation in study abroad, we're all creatures of the 20s and the 30s. In many ways, was the product of that. We, right now, talking across borders, you know, in different countries about these things, are in many ways the product of that. And my native Alps played a part in making it somehow happen, for better or worse, and that's how the project sprouted.
And when we're talking of the Alps, it's a vast area. Yeah. So is it mainly the Italian Alps, the Swiss Alps? Is it all the Alps? How does it play out?
Well, I actually, one of the reasons why I intellectually picked the Alps was because it is a transnational area. It's an international area. So I followed actually how it was defined over time, because not everyone agreed on where the Alps began and ended.
Yes.
And certainly they didn't agree on where the border should be. And I looked then, I tried to really look as much as possible at all of the surface through which they extended in different ways. So I used documents in different languages, and it was tricky, you know, to follow different archives, to try really to follow.
Yeah. How,
because they were international, they weren't just the French Alps, the Swiss Alps, or the Italian Alps, but they were the Alps.
Oh,
and so, and politically, many of the people living in them or on them, you know, historically they always had a bit of a skittish relationship with the nations they belonged to.
Yes,
because they felt alpine. Well, they felt, you know, belonging to the Alps and having a bond with other alpine people, regions, and customs, more than with the nations that they were affiliated with.
Yeah.
And so I was intrigued by that tension.
Because when you're standing on the Alps, you're, in a sense, standing above the nation that's below you.
Yeah.
So I can see the bond with other communities that are also on all these mountaintops and slopes.
It's a different place. It's certainly a separate place that often makes one feel a bond more with other people from the similar community than with the rest of the country.
Yeah.
They might come as a tourist, but it's not really from there.
Yeah. Oh, fascinating. Now, when we think generally of the 20s and 30s, we tend to have fairly ugly images, I think. The rise of fascism, Nazism, these troops marching, their black uniforms, and so on, the drums of war, and ultimately ending with the Second World War. So where does this that you're talking of, internationalism, peace, cooperation, the Alps, fit in that sort of darker picture?
Well, for starters, you know, internationalism is not particularly light either. There is an ugly face to internationalism, too, you know. So internationalism fundamentally is a set of belief and practices. It's a set of things that people say and do that makes them believe and makes them think that it is really important, whatever is their agenda, to involve people from other countries.
Mm.
So internationalism is not good by definition,
right,
nor particularly attached to one side of the political spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
The fascists were internationalists in the sense that they tried to make links with fascist parties across countries.
Mm.
And in many cases, they were actually active in international organizations, like many of the ones I mentioned in my book as well, that we tend to associate with the light, better, lighter, prettier mm-hmm. internationalism. So for right. starters, internationalism itself is not particularly lighter compared yeah. to a dark nationalism. It's a way of operating
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
in which the fascists engage too, the communists engage.
Which and anyone all can use.
Which mm-hmm. anyone can use and anyone used.
Mm.
Now, there was that element of internationalism that emphasized the friendship and pacifist end.
Mm-hmm.
That certainly one can see at odds with the warmongering on the yes. other side.
Yes.
And that I do assess as perhaps more relevant than sometimes we like it to think of, because
mm-hmm.
we like to imagine. We tend to be driven by wars
yes.
as bookmarks,
yes.
as beginning and end chapters. But if we think about the 20th century not as ending in 1945, but extending
mm-hmm.
to later decades, we can see many of the seeds of international cooperation that led to things like the European Union or mm-hmm. the Erasmus programs mm-hmm. or all of these things that created a consciousness in Europe and elsewhere that they were not just members of nations, but were members of a human family that goes across borders.
Mm-hmm.
Many of these did start in this period, and we see them today.
Mm-hmm.
And we know we live in troubled times and worrisome time. There is still, though, a sense that perhaps we're not just members of nations pitched against one another. We're more than that.
Mm.
And perhaps some of that sense
right.
we should analyze historically and recognize came from the 20s and the 30s as well.
Right. Uh-huh. Well, and that's an important legacy, as you're saying.
And that is an important legacy.
Mm. Now, we're historians.
Mm-hmm.
We like to go to archives. Where does one go to do this kind of history? What are your sources?
Well, in many places, in many languages. So, first of all, just want to say a couple of things about the kind of sources that one looks at, right? So, you look for things that people said, speeches, memoirs, things that people wrote, right? You look for images, you look for architectural designs.
These would be published or not necessarily?
Not necessarily, mm-hmm. Well, I looked at both, published and mm-hmm. archival materials, but the mm-hmm. bulk of the research was done through archival repositories.
In manuscripts.
Manuscript documents, also images, again, architectural designs, propaganda from mm-hmm. all sides, internationalist institutions, the League of Nations had its own information office and its own way of advertising itself. So I'm thinking out loud chapter by chapter, but certainly the one of the big chapters was about the League of Nations, and the archives for that are in Geneva.
Mm-hmm.
So I did plenty of research there. Many of the institutions, international institutions that I analyzed still exist. So I looked at the UIA, is known as the UIA, the Union Internationale des Associations d'Alpinisme, and they have their headquarters in Bern. They still exist, and they were extremely kind. So let me go through their archive, and which was a room in the basement. I said, here are our papers, and use them, and they were extremely kind to let me do that. I looked at international sanatoria for the tuberculosis. And one was called La Clinique Manufacture Internationale. This was a sanatorium for workers.
Okay.
And later on, they turned into a factory. Already then, they basically had patients using machinery, so they could work and earn some money and still feel like they were active, while going through these lengthy treatments. After the war and after, tuberculosis started to be treated differently with antibiotics and so on, they converted into a factory where people affected with different kind of disabilities could work together with others.
I see.
And they were making springs, actually, from NASA and all sorts of businesses. And when I approached them, they too welcomed me like royalty. They allowed me to stay there for the time I needed to do my research, to look at their papers. Other sanatoria destroyed their papers, because there was a stigma attached to these diseases.
Sure.
And so some were quite difficult to find. But some of these were maintained in archives in different parts of Switzerland, in different parts of France, and so I used those. I used the UNESCO archives in Paris. They also had quite a bit of these sources. So it was a bit of a scavenger hunt.
Yes, I can see.
That at the same time, though, proved quite rewarding. And that's why we need to preserve archives. And that's why papers that might not seem so important to one turns out to be a treasure trove.
Absolutely.
Decades after the fact. And through that journey, just through traveling from repository to repository to visit the buildings where these places had been and sometimes still are, although now they might be a hotel or something else. I feel I learned as much as from the documents themselves.
And this is something I often tell to my students, and I'm sure you do as well. That's one of the greatest joys of our job. Might never make you very rich, but going into archives, you know, having the privilege to handle the documentary remains of people from the past. It's a privilege and a responsibility. And the people and that you meet in the process and the places that you go to see, it's just something you get that, you know, money can't buy in a sense, no? I mean, you need it, of course, but it's just such an important part of our experience, isn't it?
It is, and it's one we need to protect. You know, I'm a big advocate of digitizing things, for instance, because we do need to do that. We need to have backup copies. We need to improve access as much as possible.
Absolutely.
But I also think we need to place a lot of effort and energy and thinking into educating our youth, our people, ourselves, into respecting those records and realizing that we're handling people's stuff. And that's precious, and it needs to be done ethically, and it needs to be done just like you described so well, keeping in mind that these are what we have, the remains of our past, and what can bring us back to it.
Did your research involve actually doing any oral history, talking to any people, or they had all
not for this
then?
Project, right. Because the years I was analyzing were such that it was difficult to find, you know, people that still had, and they were still alive, they would remember the 20s. On the other hand, I did, I think, incorporate a lot of chats with people along the way that weren't quite a proper oral history, but did inform my whole framing of the project.
As they do, we're approaching the end. Are there any lingering reverberations of this phenomenon of the 20s and 30s? I mean, can they teach us anything in the light of the Russian-Ukrainian crisis of the early 2022? What are your thoughts?
Well, first, that, you know, just thinking about the history of emotions make us pay attention to emotions, which may seem basic, but it's crucial, and we might not do all the time. So I'm no expert on Russia particularly, but it does seem that for Russia, for Putin and his followers, this is a lot about honor and pride and rebuilding this greater Russia, whose boundaries were still not clear where they envisioned to be. Also seems to be a lot about the fear of the expansion of NATO. And so to have these categories in mind could be, I think, helpful. Then to understand, you know, how this kind of fears or this kind of ideas of honor and pride are originated. From the other side, we see the power of compassion, of empathy, you know, and when is that we decide to express it and how? How do we decide to act? That's also something historians of emotion teach. Certainly makes us think about the media and the role of the media in instilling particular emotions in people. And then it brings up the issue of how democracies and international organizations can learn how to advertise themselves using emotions. Usually are dictatorial regimes or you know, like you were mentioning earlier, nationalist regimes that spend a lot of time and effort to make their followers feel one way or another. That was already a problem in the 20s. You know, the League of Nations, many of the pacifist groups or the more democratically inclined groups tended to be skittish about really having a proper, you know, propaganda office or manipulating emotion. Maybe we should start, in a sense, to make people feel proud of democratic values, make people feel that it's important, feel literally that it's important to defend them.
Absolutely.
And to express that perhaps more boldly than we have been.
Well, Ilaria, this was absolutely fascinating. Time has flown away. Thank you so much for joining me for this chat. I'll just revert to Maltese for a moment. Ringrazio l-Semija ta' Campus FM, tal-li kuntu miħaj għal dil-intervista ma' l-Arja Skalja. Nċenna la bil-linejt li l-Arja Skalja, għad nitkellem ħafna mill-studios ta' Campus FM, kella l-opportunità tiġi Malta permezz ta' xogħol tal-Malta Study Center fil-Hill Museum and Manuscript Library, liġi li tkellimna dwarhom, dawk li jgħidulhom tal-microphones biex ngħidu hekk, li għamlu tant xogħol ta' fejda fl-arkivi tagħna, flimkien ma' kooperazzjoni bejn l-Arkivi Nazzjonali ta' Malta, id-Dipartiment tal-Istudji tal-Arkivistika fl-Università ta' Malta u d-Dipartiment tal-Istorja tiegħi fl-Università ta' Malta. U bis-saħta dawn il-kooperazzjonijiet nibgħu ngħin fuq il-messaġġ ta' l-arja kemm importanti anke li naħsbu flimkien il-ħidma tagħna. Emmanuel Botticelli, ringrazzjakom u nintgħu l-ġimgħa d-dieħla.